I'm Iris McAlpin, and you're listening to Pure Curiosity, an exploration of the human experience and what it takes to be mentally healthy in our modern world.
Good morning, Dr. Abramovich. How are you?
Hi, Iris. Good morning. I'm doing well. How are you doing today?
I'm great. I'm really excited to be talking to you. And I just always like to start by asking you to share with us a little bit about your work and who you are.
Absolutely. So you can call me Alex.
And okay, great.
So my name is Alex Abramovich, and I'm a scientist at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health at the Institute for Mental Health Policy Research in Toronto. I'm also an assistant professor at the Dalhousie School of Public Health at the University of Toronto. So I've been addressing the issue of LGBTQ2S youth homelessness for almost 15 years now. So this is an issue that is very dear to my heart. And my program of research primarily focuses on issues regarding LGBTQ2S youth and young adult homelessness, and really understanding their unique experiences, I would say, and, you know, their needs and challenges, with the overarching goal of providing practice and policy recommendations so that we could prevent, reduce, and ultimately end LGBTQ2S youth homelessness across Canada. I also have several projects in the area of transgender health. So really, I would say, you know, my work is very much focused on the issues around homelessness, healthcare, and housing.
Wow. There's so much that I just want to jump in with right away. But the first thing that I just, maybe only in the last 6 months, did I become familiar with the concept of two spirits. And, you know, in the U.S., we usually say LGBTQIA. And
yeah.
So I would love for you, for our listeners who don't know about the 2S part, for you to share what that is.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, very important question for sure.
Yeah.
So two-spirit is a modern term, which is culturally specific to people of Indigenous ancestry. And it refers specifically to Indigenous people, actually, who identify as having both a masculine and a feminine spirit. And but the term is not exclusive to gender identity. It also refers to sexual orientation and also to spiritual identity. But I think it's very important to note that two-spirit is really a term that is very specific to Indigenous people.
Got it. Great. Yeah. And so this is a really broad question, but I think we can kind of narrow our focus over time. But I am interested to know what you're observing in the homeless population that you're working with in terms of mental health challenges.
For starters, I just want to start off by saying that LGBTQ2S youth are overrepresented among the homeless youth population.
Yeah.
And so, and it's really across North America, you know, so we know that up to 40% of youth who are experiencing homelessness identify as LGBTQ2S. So they're, you know, there's like really overrepresented, and that number might actually be higher. We don't actually know, because we haven't really been collecting the data. We haven't been collecting inclusive data up until very recently. And even still, it's not happening across the country, I would say, in a way that we could feel really confident that we're, you know, collecting the data and asking the questions. So we don't know what the numbers are. You know, I think that they differ, you know, from community to community. But overall, you know, it's safe to say that these numbers are very high. And in terms of observations, I mean, first of all, like, you know, the numbers are so high because for all youth, I mean, homelessness, usually the pathway to homelessness is family conflict. And that's regardless of, you know, how a person identifies. But family conflict is really sort of like the leading cause of homelessness for young people. But then when we look at LGBTQ2S youth, it still is family conflict, but it's more specific to identity-based family conflict. And so that has to do with a young person coming out as queer or trans. And, you know, so they come out and oftentimes, you know, the parents might kick them out or they might be forced to leave home. And so that's really the main cause of homelessness among this population. And then I would say, like, you know, if we're talking about mental health, obviously mental health is a very significant issue for LGBTQ youth, especially for those who are experiencing homelessness, right? And so the added stress and stigma that youth have when it comes to not having a safe place to call home, which, so, you know, so sadly is really oftentimes the case. Being at home, living with their parents oftentimes is not safe. So they're, you know, they're forced to leave home, but then they leave home and then they can't find a safe place because many programs aren't actually equipped or trained to provide the appropriate support. And so, yeah. And so youth, you know, they often are subjected to discrimination, violence, and stigma. And, you know, as you know, that has a very negative impact on a person's mental health. And so among this population, you know, there are high rates of depression, anxiety, substance use, suicide, compared to heterosexual and cisgender youth.
Yeah, my mom was doing some work at Larkin Street Youth Services in San Francisco for a while. Yeah. And she told me, and you know, this was something that I didn't know a lot about in Texas. This is where I grew up. This wasn't really part of the cultural conversation quite as much. And she told me that a lot of the kids who were staying in the shelter, their family members would buy them a bus ticket and say, "Oh yeah, your aunt or somebody, you know, we have this friend in San Francisco that will take care of you," when there actually was no such person. And they would just ship them off to San Francisco and they would be left completely without any resources. And I couldn't believe that. I mean, on some level I can believe it, but it's pretty heartbreaking how common of a story that actually is.
Yeah, you know, that actually is a very common narrative and something that I've definitely heard as well, very similar situations. And I do want to add though, because I think it's very important to acknowledge that youth have very different experiences within the LGBTQ2S population. So, you know, depending on how a person identifies, like they're going to have a different experience. So for example, some LGBTQ youth are more likely to experience homelessness and poverty than others. Like for example, Indigenous LGBTQ youth and LGBTQ youth of color, they experience homelessness at disproportionate rates. And then if we look a little deeper, some LGBTQ2S youth experience discrimination and violence at higher rates than others as well. So trans people of color, especially young trans women of color, they face, you know, the highest rates of discrimination and violence, and they're more likely to experience violent crime, sexual assault, and murder.
I'm interested to hear your perspective on, I mean, this is a big question and I don't expect you to like know the answer, but because I know you're on the ground, you're working on this. And what are some of the things that are being done to try to turn this around?
I think that sadly, it's only been, you know, until, you know, very recently that there have been more specialized programs that have opened, right, to actually meet the needs of the population, and also in the US and in Canada. So some of the things that are being done, I would say, you know, in Canada, for example, in recent years, so in 2016, Canada's first population-based housing program, so a housing program that is specifically for LGBTQ2S youth,
yeah,
opened in Toronto. And that was a huge milestone, a major milestone. YMCA is the service, that the organization that operates the program. It's called Sprott House. So it's a transitional housing program for LGBTQ youth. And it's essentially a 25-bed facility that provides a safe, you know, a safe, affirming, and inclusive place for youth to live for up to 2 years. You know, that's really major. That is a major breakthrough, actually, was the opening of that service. There are services like that exist also in the US. And we know that these types of population-based services are so important. Like, these are the kinds of services that actually save people's lives.
Mm-hmm. For people who may be wondering, what is it that makes it so essential for there to be designated housing and specific training for people within this population?
For a lot of youth, you know, like I said earlier, they experience discrimination and social stigma when they access services. And because many of the services, they tend to use a sort of one size fits all approach. But that doesn't work because one size doesn't fit all, right? And so, you know, especially for a lot of the youth who I work with, you know, they're going to have various unique needs, especially for trans youth, you know, who might be medically transitioning. Maybe they're trying to access hormones or transition-related surgery. And so their needs are going to be quite different. And so you can only imagine what it would be like to go to a service where nobody at the program has any idea how to address you, how to support you, how to help you in any way. That will very quickly drive youth out of the service And then they end up in, you know, in really unsafe situations, sleeping in the park, in an alleyway, where they're for sure not going to receive any support and or safety. And so there's just so many levels. It's such a complex issue, right? And so it comes, there's like so many different ways that this plays out in a program. You know, even when you go to a program or a doctor's office and there's forms that we have to fill out, all of us as a patient, you know, we'd have to fill out a form, and the form will typically ask you, you know, for your name and your sex. It'll say male or female. Well, for so many people, they don't fit into those two categories. Right. And so, you know, if we're not asking inclusive questions, then we're actually erasing people. We're actually erasing their identities. And so we're forcing people to fit into categories that they don't fit in. And that creates, you know, a lot of barriers for people to access programs in a way that would actually help them.
Absolutely. And that itself is traumatic.
Yes.
Yeah. How did you get interested in this? What is the pathway to this for you?
So I'm trans myself. I'm a trans man. I mean, I've always been very interested in issues regarding homelessness for as long as I can remember. Even as a child, you know, before I came out, like that homelessness was something that I had a very strong interest in. And, you know, as a kid, really wanted to understand, why is it that some people have a home and others don't? I think it's very hard for a child to wrap their head around that. Yeah. And so, but then, you know, as I grew older and I came out and had a pretty rough coming out experience, didn't really have a lot of support and faced a lot of challenges as a young person. Yeah. I very quickly came to understand, you know, that there is a very strong link between a young person coming out as LGBTQ and homelessness, that those two are very connected. And so that's when I first understood that there's this strong connection. And so there's for sure going to be an overrepresentation of LGBTQ youth. And I wanted to understand back then, like, where would you go for support? If you're kicked out of the house, you have nowhere to go, you know, you're in crisis, you're experiencing trauma, where do you go for support? Mm-hmm. Kind of a long story to say that it came from my own personal sort of life experience that really led me to this work.
This is another huge question that, you know, we can play with and see where it goes. But it's just, what is your sense of what's so threatening about this for families, that they're unable to be supportive with their children having these experiences?
That's an excellent question. And, you know, one that I really wish that I could truly understand on a deeper level.
It is hard to wrap my head around.
Yeah. You know, like for so many of the youth who I work with, like I said, family conflict is such a strong issue. And I've worked with a lot of youth whose lives have been threatened by their parents. Mm. You know, their parents have actually threatened to kill them, and they've had to leave a situation like that. And so I have often wondered, like, what is it that is so threatening to these parents? And I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, perhaps a lot of the parents, maybe they have a certain idea. You know, when their child is born, it's like you're presented with your child. It's like, oh, it's a baby girl, or, you know? And so right. I think that people get very attached to what that means and what that is going to look like. And they have their own sort of ideas that they obviously, you know, put onto that child. And as soon as that doesn't happen, I think that kind of disrupts something, right? And I think, I really think it has to do with that. I think it has to do with just having an idea of what your life is going to look like, you know, or what your life might look like, or what it means to be a man or a woman, or, in terms of not just for trans youth, but also for lesbian and gay and bisexual youth, you know, maybe, you know, their parents have a very strong attachment to their child being heterosexual or straight. And, you know, when that doesn't happen, I guess there's something very threatening about that for some people.
I definitely think that's a huge part of it. And I know religiousness can also play a role. And I sort of wonder as well if it puts people in touch with their own gender conflict. Because I do feel like, you know, we're sort of thrust into these boxes from birth. And some people just manage to kind of skip along without ever really thinking deeply about that or questioning that. But then I think there are a lot of people that do. I mean, I know for myself, I'm a bisexual woman, and I grappled deeply with gender as a child and couldn't really, I remember trying to talk about it and just feeling wildly misunderstood. And I think maybe for some people, it forces them to ask some of these questions that they've been avoiding asking, and that might be pretty confronting.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yes, I definitely agree with you. I think that, yeah, like you said, you know, I think we're born into this system, into this society. It's very, you know, it happens very early on. Like you're wrapped in a pink blanket.
Well, exactly. Still happens, right? Like, for sure.
My partner just had a baby and it's like they have a pink and a blue blanket and that is, and they're very attached to that, right? And so we're born into this system and, you know, there's this idea that we're just going to go along and we're going to, you know, fit right into the system. And I think that for some of us, maybe these questions might come up, there might be some discomfort, but then we're sort of like forced to push it away because it's like bad, it's wrong to actually start to really question like, oh, okay, well, what is my gender identity? And I think, I'm sure for a lot of the parents that, you know, these questions probably come up for themselves and there's actually a lot of hatred because I think that's what like homophobia, transphobia, and biphobia comes down to is really hatred. And some of the people who are the most hateful actually are the ones who are probably the most confused themselves.
Yes.
Right?
I have seen that so many times. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I do think, you know, I had a roommate for a while that was a trans man and just learned a lot about his family history and how difficult it was for him to come out and, you know, his family won't talk to him and all these kinds of things. And religiousness was a huge factor in that. And it's just one of those things that I still find myself grappling with. Like, you know, I'm someone who likes to find solutions and wants there to be, you know, communal healing. And it's really tough. I don't know what to do with that. I'm just hoping that as this becomes a more prominent part of the cultural conversation, the people in leadership positions within spiritual communities will start to open their hearts to this and find their compassion, which is sort of ironic because that's a lot of what gets preached, but somehow it seems to end with this.
Yeah, that's actually a very good point, right? But I do think that, you know, I think that things are slowly starting to change, but I mean, I'm not saying that we're in this great position right now where things are so wonderful. I think we still have a long way to go, but I think that, you know, a lot of the services meant to provide support to people experiencing homelessness are often actually faith-based. You know, so many of those big organizations are faith-based. And historically, I think a lot of them have not been accepting and have actually very much, you know, rejected LGBTQ2S people, not just youth. And that's, you know, a narrative that I also heard quite often when I first started doing this work almost 15 years ago. But now I think that, you know, I'm starting to hear things are starting to change a bit. So some of those major faith-based organizations are even opening up programs that are LGBTQ2S focused.
That's really interesting. And I have to say, I never even thought about that because you're right. A lot of these social services programs are religiously based and funded by churches or other spiritual entities. And that could be a real problem.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So something I'm curious to hear more about is what types, like obviously there's, you know, fulfilling people's basic needs and getting a roof over their heads and making sure that they're physically safe. What kind of work is being done around mental and emotional safety?
So the example that I provided you with in terms of YMCA Sprott House, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, that is like a housing, that's a housing program. But what makes that program different and programs like that different is that they are so specialized. And so everything that they do, all of the programs that they operate in addition to housing are all designed from an LGBTQ2S lens with a very deep understanding of what the unique needs and barriers might be for the youth who access their programs. And a lot of the staff actually who work at these programs are also LGBTQ themselves and are very open about their identity, which actually makes a very big difference for youth. And so, you know, many of the youth who I work with talk a lot about how, you know, how different it is to have a staff member who you can relate to. And I think for all of us, we all want someone that we can relate to. And I think, you know, that's especially for young people, that's so important for a young person to be able to see themselves reflected in the program that they access. And, you know, young people need positive role models that they could look up to. And oftentimes that those would be people who they could actually relate to. And those components actually have you know, that all falls into the realm of mental health and providing mental health support, you know, that makes a very big difference for a young person's mental health.
Yeah. And which brings me to why we were brought together today to have this conversation. I know that this population is the most vulnerable to suicide. And so what are you seeing in that, and what's being done currently in your work to try to prevent that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, exactly. The rates of suicide are significantly higher among LGBTQ youth, and especially trans youth. That's something that we have seen in previous research, as well as the research that I'm doing, is that for young trans people, those rates are, you know, significantly higher, and especially for young trans people who want to medically transition. So, for example, you know, they might want to start hormones or transition related surgery, and so for young people who want to medically transition but have not yet done so, you know, they're in that waiting period. Maybe they're on a wait list, or, I mean, now with COVID, a lot of those appointments have been canceled.
Right.
And so we know that when they're in that phase of waiting, the risk of suicide actually increases significantly in comparison to a trans person who's already medically transitioned. So, you know, when we see that, obviously, you know, the next thing that we think of is that we have to be able to provide that support for, you know, a young trans person who is ready to medically transition, that they shouldn't have to wait that long. We shouldn't be canceling these appointments. I think it's very important that primary care practitioners understand that they can prescribe hormones, actually, and that there are many, you know, there are many guides available online as well. Some really great ones developed by physicians in Toronto on how to safely prescribe hormones.
I guess I'm just sort of thinking about this from the perspective of somebody who's listening, who knows, you know, maybe they have a child, maybe they have, you know, a cousin or a niece or a dear friend, somebody who's going through this. What kind of resources are available for people to try to understand this better and to provide better support for the people in their lives who are going through this transition?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an excellent and very important question. I mean, luckily today, there are a lot of excellent resources available online. You know, that is a really wonderful thing that there are, you know, a lot of the programs and services that are LGBTQ2S focused or specialized, they have produced these different resources that are available for download, and they are meant to actually provide support to families of young people. For if we're talking specifically about trans youth, there are actual resources available for parents and families of trans youth on how to appropriately, you know, support them. And I think that you know, I'm happy to send you those resources.
Great.
Yeah. Listeners can definitely download those. We could share the links. And I think that it's very important for people to understand that family support for LGBTQ2S youth is often like, it's a life or death situation, right? And so LGBTQ2S youth are actually, they're 8 times more likely to attempt suicide when their parents reject them. Right. So that's huge. Right. And then, you know, so there's very clear health benefits that are experienced by trans youth who have supportive relationships and by those who can actually live safely in their authentic gender. So I would say that family support is absolutely critical to the health and well-being of young LGBTQ2S people. And I say that with the understanding that it's not always possible, right? There's for sure going to be youth who, like I described earlier, you know, whose parents have threatened their lives, where there's no chance of family reunification. But there are often family members who are supportive. Maybe it's a cousin or an aunt or an uncle. And so I think it's very important to work on those relationships and to provide the resources that could help families support their youth.
This is getting into maybe murky territory here, but I'm just sort of, I actually had a conversation with a woman over the weekend who had a trans son who committed suicide, and she was supportive of the transition. And I don't know the specific details of the situation, but I'm wondering for these youth that are in this waiting period, what is your sense of what's happening that is getting them to that place?
I mean, I know I've been talking a lot about family, and it's not all about family, of course. I mean, family is very important, and it's so important to have that family support. But then, of course, there are things that, you know, a family can't control, like when a young person, or for that matter, any person, you know, leaves the house and you go out into the world, which is oftentimes not a safe place, right? And there are, you know, there people are, especially trans people, experience discrimination and stigma and violence at very high rates. And that's something that the family can't control. And I think, you know, that It's just so layered. It happens yeah. in so many different ways, like this type of transphobia and discrimination. It's not just to say that it's like, oh, you know, you go to this one place and that's where you might experience discrimination. It's very difficult to live your life in a way where everywhere you go, you are experiencing discrimination in some form or another, right? And so, for example, like every single time you have to fill out a form, you don't see yourself on that form. There's nothing that you can check off that identifies you. And so then you always have to check off other. And that you can only imagine, you know, what that feels like. That's othering. And that doesn't feel good for anyone, you know?
Yeah, it's like death by 1,000 paper cuts.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And every time you go into a public space and you're trying to act, you have to use the bathroom. Such a basic human need. Well, then you realize that there's actually no bathroom that you can use because the only bathrooms that are available are for men or for women. And every time you try to access one of those, somebody chases you in and yells at you or tells you that you're in the wrong bathroom. These are the kinds of things that happen to a lot of trans people on a daily basis. And, you know, also, you know, not having your name or your pronouns respected. So having someone refer to you by the wrong name and having someone refer to you as she when you're actually he. These things have a negative impact on a person's mental health. And those are the kinds of things actually that result in suicide, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, I'm just sort of wondering as you're talking about this, and I don't care about being realistic at all. Like if you could wave a magic wand and see some things change, what do you identify as some of the key things in our culture and society that need to shift in order to really be adequately supportive?
Well, I mean, I'm going to start off really basic here and just say that I would say for starters that it's not enough to respond to these issues only in urban areas, right? Or right. only in some parts of the country, but not in other parts, which is what we see happen all the time, where it's like, you know, people have this idea that, oh, only, you know, LGBTQ people exist in like larger cities and in urban settings. And so we're not going to address these issues in like a rural or more remote community. Well, you know, LGBTQ people exist everywhere across the country in all communities, right? And I think it's very important to understand that and to make sure that we have programs and services that meet people's need all across the country. I would say it's not enough for us, but rather for programs to put up, you know, some rainbow flags and celebrate Pride once a year and show your support, you know, once a year and say that you're doing the best that you can do. That's not good enough. We have to actually prioritize this issue. And I think it's very important that the government and, you know, policies, targeted strategies, services, that we really prioritize different populations that are disproportionately represented. In this case, we're talking about LGBTQ youth. So this population needs to become a priority in the way that we address different issues such as homelessness and poverty. You know, earlier I said about family support, which I would say that's really key. And also for young people to have positive role models that they could look up to. That's also, you know, really important to make sure that when you're hiring staff in your programs, make sure that you're hiring a diverse range of people with, you know, different identities so that young people can actually relate and see themselves reflected. I would also say that people have to be treated with respect in their self-identified gender. And I think that a very good starting point for everybody is to, in terms of like to be inclusive and to promote inclusion, is to not make assumptions about people. It's like, it sounds so simple because it is a very simple thing. Don't assume that you know how a person identifies or which pronouns they go by just by looking at them, because we can't know. There's no way that we can know what pronouns or how a person identifies just by looking at them. It's very important that we get into the habit of asking people, you know, how would you like to be addressed? What pronouns do you go by? What name do you go by? I think that's very important practice for all programs to, you know, to include.
Yeah, I love that. And thankfully, you know, living in California, that's become much more common. And like, I know my husband's business, at their staff meetings, they always start by, you know, addressing pronouns. And I'm seeing more and more businesses in California stepping into that. But I also know that in other parts of the country, that's definitely not happening as much. And I am kind of curious. I mean, I'm sure you're at least to some degree aware of what's been happening in the US and just how much tension there is and how much division there is and our president's stance on trans rights and all of this. What is the climate in Canada? Is it more hopeful than what we're seeing here?
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely say it is much more hopeful for sure.
Good.
Yeah, there's definitely more sort of like protection in terms of the human rights code for trans people, for gender identity. I think that we're definitely seeing a lot more support around, you know, LGBTQ2S health, for example, and, you know, certain services that have opened and policies. But, you know, still it's like, of course, when you compare, yes, I would say, I think that we're doing pretty good here in Canada. But, you know, not comparing and just really looking at what the situation is like here, you know, we still do have a long way to go. And especially, as I mentioned earlier, just sort of like this idea that for politicians, for government, to, you know, where it's like, oh, we're doing all that we can do. You know, there's not much more we can do. I definitely don't buy that, because, you know, why is it that there are so many LGBTQ youth still experiencing homelessness? Why are those rates so high? And why, in terms of suicidality and mental health issues, these are still very significant problems. I think that if we were appropriately addressing these issues, then we wouldn't be seeing those numbers.
What role do you think having more accessible healthcare plays in this? Because I'm just thinking right now about the state of affairs here and just how many people don't have basic health insurance and just the astronomical cost of getting any kind of treatment here. You know, do you feel like that is part of the reason why things are a little bit more hopeful in Canada?
Yeah, I mean, I think, of course, having access to healthcare is really huge. And especially for, you know, I just wrapped up the first phase of a major study in which we identified over 2,000 trans people in Ontario using administrative health data. And we were able to track sort of, you know, we were able to look at where do those 2,000 people live, you know, what kind of neighborhoods are they living in, what kind of chronic health conditions do they have, and how are they accessing the healthcare system. So we were able to look at how often are trans folks hospitalized or are visiting the emergency department or their primary care practitioner or, you know, specialist. So we were able to look at that and also look a bit deeper and see, you know, how often did those visits have to do with mental health or suicidality or self-harm. And then we were able to compare that to the general population in terms of, you know, with the same, compared to the same age in the general population, a cohort. And so and you know, we're talking about a place where people have access to the healthcare system. You can very easily access the healthcare system. But yeah, and so we wanted to understand, what is this like for trans people? Because previous studies have actually noted, you know, in Canada that trans folks actually avoid the healthcare system because it's not inclusive. And because it's just really not a very trans-affirming space, most of the healthcare settings, unless they're specialized, like unless it's like a specialty sort of trans health clinic. But we actually found that trans folks, among those 2,000 trans folks, they are actually accessing healthcare much more frequently than the general population. So there were a lot more emergency department visits, hospitalizations, and just sort of like general practitioner visits.
Interesting. What were the other findings that you found? Because I looked over the study before we talked a little bit. It seemed like there were some pretty interesting patterns that emerged.
Yeah. So, you know, first of all, we found that that among those 2,085 trans people, that the average age, it was a pretty young group, the average age was 30. And so I'm not sure if that's because it's a little bit more difficult maybe to identify older trans folks. Maybe they're not out at the, you know, maybe they don't come out as trans when they're accessing healthcare, or I'm not quite sure what the reason for that is, but we are going to have to dig a bit deeper in the next phase and try to identify, you know, maybe some older people as well. And so we also found that among the trans people identified, that they tend to live in lower income neighborhoods and that they experience chronic physical and mental health conditions at higher rates. So for example, asthma, diabetes, HIV, COPD. So those are some of the findings. And I think, you know, it has a lot to do, like I said earlier, with stigma and discrimination. And I think, you know, I think it's very important to know it's not because a person is trans that they're going to be unhealthy or, you know, that they're going to, that these are the outcomes, but it has everything to do with the experience in society. You know, everything that we've been talking about in terms of stigma and discrimination and violence, that is, you know, that has, that plays a very big role in a person's health, and it leads to poor health outcomes.
Absolutely. I mean, that's just proof of how much of a deleterious role stress has on the body.
Yes, absolutely.
What are some of the other questions, you know, in your continuing research that you're hoping to answer with some of your studies?
So for the study that I was just telling you about in terms of trans health, we are going to go into phase two, and we're going to be looking a bit closer at how marginalization and gender identity intersect. Mm-hmm. So now that we found that trans people have, you know, poor health conditions and, you know, live in lower income neighborhoods, well, we want to understand a bit deeper as to like, why is that so? And so we're hoping to determine, you know, how does marginalization impact mental health related health service use? So when I say that, I'm talking about when a person, trans person ends up in the emergency department or if they're hospitalized. Well, we want to understand like when it has to do with self-harm or mental health, we want to understand the role that marginalization plays and stigma. So that's for that study. And that's, you know, that's an ongoing study. It's a large study that we continue to work on. But then for my other work on LGBTQ youth homelessness, I'm just about to begin a brand new study that is focused on COVID. Actually, it's COVID related. Oh, wow. Yes. And we're going to be looking specifically at the impact of COVID-19 on LGBTQ youth who are experiencing homelessness. So we really want to understand, you know, what has been happening over the past 6 months for youth, because we know that for many youth who identify as LGBTQ, you know, they have either been forced back into unsafe home situations because they were many programs shut down. So, you know, or they weren't able to couch surf anymore. So they had to go back into an unsafe, you know, family situation. So we want to understand sort of what happened there. And then as we've been talking about for many of the trans youth, their appointments were canceled. You know, they were waiting for transition-related surgery. Well, that was postponed. So we're going to look at how that played out.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because that is something I have been thinking about is what is happening for homeless, I mean, the general homeless population, but specifically within this population. And I think it's going to be sobering to uncover what's actually been going on.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially because prior to COVID, LGBTQ youth already experienced, you know, high rates of mental health issues and suicidality. So I can only imagine what, you know, what that would look like now with COVID and everything that's been happening.
Yeah. Well, I definitely want to be updated on what you find. And yes. Would it be okay with you if we kind of took a turn into a slightly more personal realm?
Yeah, for sure.
You mentioned that you had a difficult coming out experience, and I'm just interested because I imagine there may be people listening to this who, you know, are starting this process themselves, or maybe they, you know, are wanting to come out. How were you able to manage the challenges of that? And obviously, you know, you're doing wonderful things now. And so if you wouldn't mind sharing just a little bit of that path.
Mm-hmm, for sure. You know, so I should say that, so I've had two major coming out experiences in my life. So before I came out as a trans man, you know, I was assigned female at birth. And so I lived my life as a woman actually for, you know, for a long time. And I originally had the coming out experience that I've been talking about in terms of that was like really difficult was when I first came out. And the first time I came out, I actually came out as a lesbian. And so back then, you know, there really wasn't a lot of support available. And it was a very confusing time, very challenging time. And I was obviously in a very different place in my life than I was when I came out the second time. About 10 years later, I came out as a trans man. And so I'm going to talk about that coming out because to me, that feels really kind of relevant to our discussion here. And so I came out when I was in the middle of working on my PhD. You know, during that time, also, there wasn't, it wasn't the way that it is today, I feel, and it wasn't even that long ago, but, you know, I feel like it, the conversation around like, around trans health or any issues related to trans people wasn't really part of like the larger conversation. And so for me to, you know, come out in a major university in Toronto was, it was very challenging. And I didn't know if I could, you know, make it through my PhD because every day, every time I stepped foot into the university, I also worked at a large hospital actually in downtown Toronto. It just wasn't a supportive environment. It was very challenging, but, you know, somehow I managed to push through. You know, looking back now, I feel like it's always like that with difficult situations. You look back and you're like, oh my gosh, I don't know how I did that.
Yeah.
Right. And so, yeah, I mean, it was really challenging and I felt like I didn't really have people that I could relate to. I didn't really know trans people. So that's, I feel like that made it really challenging for me, is that I just didn't have that support. I didn't have people that I could relate to. But I eventually found my way, and I eventually found that, you know, that there were resources available, like online. There was a whole community online, you know, for example, on YouTube, a lot of people post videos, like vlogs, I guess, right? Yeah. So it's like a blog, but it's a video. And a lot of people, there were a lot of trans people sharing their experiences. And so I was able to find community, you know, within people who I didn't even know, you know, there are people from all over the place. And we just started messaging each other. And I found that that was very helpful. And that's something that I often, you know, when a lot of youth contact me, a lot of youth who have just come out and they don't have any support, they don't know, you know, who they can talk to. And, you know, I always try to offer my support. And I always remember that there are different forums online, you know, especially today, where people are willing to share their experience. And I think that you could really find community even, you know, online, especially for people who might be located in a community or in a region that where there are less services available.
Yeah. And so I guess I'm also thinking, you know, if there are people listening that are in your shoes where you were in school, what would you say to them? Or maybe we could just say, what would you say to your younger self?
I mean, I guess I would say, if you're struggling because you're afraid to come out, which I was, for me, you know, I was really, I struggled a lot because I didn't know if I could come out. I didn't feel like I could come out. To me, it felt like I wouldn't be able to live authentically in this lifetime. That's how it always felt. And it's interesting because I've heard other people talk about that. And, you know, many young people talk about that, that they just feel like, no, there's no way, you know, I know that I'm trans, but there's no way that I could come out because I won't be able to actually live authentically in this lifetime. Because for myself, anyways, I was very worried that I would lose everyone. I was very worried that people wouldn't accept me. And I think that's also very common, is that that's what people struggle with, is that fear that you're going to lose it all. And, you know, it's like, how can I live without, you know, I'm going to lose everyone. So I know exactly what that feels like, because that's, you know, that's how I felt. And I would say that that people will surprise you, actually. You know, over the years, I've learned that even the most resistant people can actually change. And I'm also, you know, I'm talking about people who have the authority to actually implement real world change, as well as, you know, organizations who have maybe historically been homophobic, transphobic, or biphobic, and friends and family member. I really do believe that the most resistant people can change, and that sometimes people just need some extra time and some resources. And I think it's very important to keep that in mind, but also to acknowledge that there are going to be people who don't change. Of course, I'm not saying that everybody can change, but there are some people who won't. But my advice is really to find the people who do accept you for who you are, and to stick with those people. Surround yourself with the people who do accept you and who see you for who you truly are. Because I think that's very, you know, that's very important, is to really spend time with those people. And what I would tell my younger self really is to remember that there's nothing more beautiful than being able to live your life authentically.
That's beautiful. Thank you. Yeah. And I couldn't help but think, as you were sharing your story too, oh, what a stressful time in your life to do that. I mean, getting a PhD, I haven't lived this myself, but I can only imagine that was a lot of stress on top of stress. And it made me wonder, what was it about that time when that really felt like, okay, now is the time that I'm going to embrace this and step into this?
That's such a good question. You know, what it was, actually, it was because I was working with so many youth, as I have been for, you know, for so many years now. I was working very closely with youth. I was interviewing them for my research, for my, you know, my thesis at the time. And I was asking youth about their, you know, most difficult experiences in their lives, about trauma. You know, they are reflecting on the rejection that they experienced, on their own identities. And I'll never forget this. I was actually interviewing a young trans woman, and she turned to me and said, well, you're trans, right? Mm-hmm. What does it feel like for you? And I had never actually told anyone that I was trans at that time. Like, that I hadn't come out yet, but I knew that I was trans. And I left that interview, and I was like, now, you know what? I have to come out. Now is the time that I have to come out. I have to live authentically. How can I be doing this work and asking people all these questions, but I myself am not living authentically? So that really was, that's what it was for me.
I relate to that so much. I mean, in a different way, but it was sort of similar in the sense that I was coaching. And at that point, I was just doing it part-time, kind of on the side. But I hadn't told anybody that I was, you know, that I had a long history of depression and bulimia and PTSD. And I was terrified to tell anyone. And at a certain point, I just recognized if I'm going to be helping people move through this, you know, if I'm not willing to talk about it, then how can I expect them to be willing to talk about it? And so I kind of bit the bullet and put it out there. But wow, it was also quite scary.
Yes, absolutely. But like so powerful, right?
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't change it for anything. And I think I know the answer to this question, but I'll just ask it explicitly. Have the quality of your connections and relationships deepened since you did that?
Yes, 100%. You know, even though like my personal and professional journey has been a very difficult path to travel. And because of my identity, I've experienced a lot of challenges. And I don't really talk about this stuff too much, but it hasn't been easy. But, you know, coming out and being myself is literally the best thing that has ever happened to me. Not only, you know, did it lead me to a career that I feel extremely passionate about, but you know, being able to live authentically also allowed me to fall in love and start a family, which I am forever grateful for. And I truly wish for every young person to be able to be safe and supported while living authentically without losing their home or, you know, and their family. I truly believe that every person deserves this.
I do too. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today and share your story. I know, you know, we've only covered the tip of the iceberg here, but I'm really grateful for your perspective and for the work that you're doing.
Oh, you're so welcome. And thank you so much for inviting me on the show. I really appreciate it.